But the U.S. and U.K. and a few other countries are all out supporting Israel in doing this, and they have been since 1917 when England issued the Balfour Declaration. That's why we say you've got to look at the historical context. In 1917, the United Kingdom issued a Balfour Declaration to the small, young Zionist movement in Europe, saying we support the creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And Palestine was 95% Arab. There was a small Jewish community that had always existed there and should always exist there, but it was 95% Arab. It's like me saying there should be a Palestinian homeland in the center of Manhattan. It just is not it's not right. It's not possible. You can't take somebody else's land and create your own country. And since 1917, the Zionist movement, then the State of Israel, supported by the U.S. and U.K. and others, has enthusiastically pursued the plan to diminish the number of Palestinians living in Palestine so you can have an exclusively Jewish state, which is the government policy now of this government in Israel. But it has failed. It has failed because the number of Palestinians between the historic Palestine from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, which includes Israel and some of the occupied territories, there are more Palestinians now than Israelis, more Christian and Muslim Palestinians than Jewish Israelis. So not only is the Israeli plan vicious and cruel and criminal, it's also ineffective. And the United States is pursuing its amateurish, comic, entertainment-based, cartoon-like foreign policy to support this, knowing that it's going to fail. And, you know, the airdrops were the best example of this. The poor, those five poor kids were killed by these, you know, food packets that fell on them and killed them. This is unbelievable that the United States would carry out these kinds of policies. The pontoon bridge is another one. There's so many ramifications of that also that haven't been discussed or explored in terms of what it's going to mean in terms of recreating Israeli direct security control mechanisms in Gaza to protect the food and allow it to be distributed. Who's going to distribute it? Is this going to create new mechanisms which already are starting to take shape now of lawless gang-like behavior among starving, desperate Palestinians? And this is human nature. Anybody who's starving and desperate is going to create gangs and to go get the food and distribute it. And this is exactly what's happening. And this is exactly what the Israelis want. They want the Palestinians to act in this manner, and therefore the Israelis can show the world, look at these people, these are animals, these Palestinians, and they want to drive them out. And there's another fear also that if UNRWA is not allowed to continue its activities, the distribution process will end up being either politicized or criminalized, and this is with the direct involvement of the Israelis and the Americans and some Arab countries, and this is also not a very very good idea.
Rani Khoury,
so there are many.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Palestinian American journalist, senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. Joining us today from New York. When we come back, we speak with civil rights advocate and author Michelle Alexander, who says only revolutionary love can save us now. Back in 20 seconds.
Nothing remains the same. Everyone must change. No one and nothing remains the same. Now becomes yours.
Everything must change, sung by Nina Simone. The song includes the words, "The young become the old and mysteries do unfold, for that's the way of time. No one and nothing stays unchanged." These are words quoted by our next guest. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Civil rights advocate Michelle Alexander has a new piece in The Nation. Its headline, Only Revolutionary Love Can Save Us Now. Michelle Alexander begins, this moment feels different. Something new is in the air. Of course, everything is always changing. Impermanence is the way of life. Philosophers, theologians, and poets have reminded us for centuries that the only constant is change. Michelle Alexander joins us now for more, the best-selling author of the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. It's great to have you back with us, Michelle.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm always happy to be here.
It's great to see you. If you can talk about what gives you hope right now, even as you write about what's happening in Gaza, as you talk about what's happening with issues of police brutality and mass incarceration through the United States, talk about movements and your references to Dr. King.
Well, what gives me hope right now is that despite everything, revolutionary love is bursting and blossoming in all kinds of places and spaces. Years of relentless and patient organizing and deep learning about each other's histories and struggles have led to a moment when Black activists are showing up at protests organized by Jewish students who are raising their voices in solidarity with Palestinians who are suffering occupation and annihilation in Gaza. And, you know, this is due to connections that have been made over the course of years between liberation struggles on the streets of Ferguson and those occurring in Palestine. And these small acts of revolutionary love are leading to movements, are building movements that just might help us change everything. And, you know, we see this in communities everywhere where people are connecting dots between climate change and racial and gender injustice. We see it in the movement to stop Cop City in Atlanta. We see it in movements for clean water and food. And we see that people are making connections between liberation struggles here at home and those occurring around the world, as well as connections between the violence of policing and incarceration and the violence of militarism and the relentless assault on Gaza. So, you know, people are turning towards really promising forms of movement building, incredible acts of courage in this moment, speaking unpopular truths. And that gives me hope, even in a time when there is so much reason for fear and anxiety that can be paralyzing.
Michelle, but you also raised in your article that all of this is happening right now in the midst of a presidential election here in the United States. And what do you see as the impact of the policy of the Biden administration in terms of especially in terms of Gaza and the genocide there and what the impact may be on the result of our election?
Well, you know, tens of thousands of people have been killed in Gaza in just a few months with our bombs, you know, mass murder funded by our government, aided and abetted by our military, paid for in large part by our tax dollars. And while we have been told by our government that we are not witnessing genocide, you know, I and millions of people around the world have watched. You know, as videos have traveled around the globe, we've watched, you know, as mothers have pulled body parts of their dead children out of rubble, as people have had their limbs amputated, sawed off without anesthesia because the hospitals have been destroyed and there's no medicine, including pain medication, to be found. We've watched as people facing starvation have been shot at by Israeli soldiers as they approach vehicles carrying aid. And so, you know, the Biden administration seems to be surprised that people who are not Palestinian care as deeply as we do. And I think if the Democratic Party and the Biden administration is serious about winning this next election, they must not only insist upon a ceasefire, but end the aid for the military support and the bombs, and must invest and ensure that the people who are starving and who are suffering there get the aid that they need to survive. We must end the occupation of Palestine and commit to the thriving of all of the people who have been subjected to relentless war and occupation for decades now. And so, yeah, I do think it's an important issue in this election year. And, you know, as I point out in the piece, that there are many, many things that are weighing on the minds and the hearts of the American people right now. It is the mass killing in Gaza, you know, more than 10,000 children, and the destruction of hospitals, schools, churches, mosques, universities, museums, and nearly all the basic infrastructure. It is the memories of the killings that occurred on October 7th, memories that many continue to carry along with deep grief and fear. But there's also, you know, fears of the threats to our democracy, to the very ideas of diversity and inclusion. And there's the threat of climate change. You know, 2023 was the hottest year on record, and it seems we may have already passed a critical tipping point. And yet the five biggest oil companies last year raked in record profits, nearly $200 billion in profits, more than the economic output of most countries. And, you know, if all that wasn't enough, we keep learning more and more that AI just might destroy humanity. And, you know, I find that people often ask me as I speak about issues related to climate change and the war in Gaza and the threats related to the rise in technology, you know, what does any of this have to do with mass incarceration or police violence, the issues and causes that have been most pressing and most important to me for much of my life? And what I always say is that these issues have everything to do with mass incarceration. These are existential crises that we face because we have persisted in treating people and all of creation as exploitable and disposable, unworthy of our care and concern. We are lost in the delusion that we can solve problems or do justice or achieve peace and security simply by locking people up, throwing away the key, destroying their lives and families, getting rid of them, declaring wars on them, wars on drugs, wars on crime, wars on Gaza. And that's why I keep returning again and again to the speech that Martin Luther King, you know, gave near the end of his life, the speech where he condemned the Vietnam War and was immediately canceled. That's what my piece in the Nation is ultimately about.
Michelle, we want to end with and get your final comment on Dr. King's speech that you gave, that he gave at New York's Riverside Church, opposing the war in Vietnam a year to the day before he was assassinated. This is Dr. King speaking about why he opposed the war in Vietnam.
As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. I have tried to offer them my deepest compassion while maintaining my conviction that social change comes most meaningfully through nonviolent action. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
Dr. King, after which you point out in the piece, Michelle, that he was canceled from the major papers, the New York Times to the Washington Post, attacked for his opposition to war.
Yes, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's difficult to overstate the political risk that he was taking in that moment. Our nation had been at war with Vietnam for 2 years. 10,000 American troops had already been killed, and the war had enthusiastic bipartisan support within the political establishment. Anyone who dared to criticize the war were often labeled communists and subjected to vicious forms of retaliation and backlash. Many of his friends and his allies told him not to speak out against the war, saying he'd jeopardize the very fragile and brand new gains of the civil rights movement. And he said, you know, those people, those voices didn't understand the depth of his moral commitment, but they also had no real understanding of the nature of the world in which they lived. And he said basic morality, you know, demands that we speak for the weak, the voiceless, the victims of our own nation, especially the children, including those our nation calls enemy, for they are no less our brothers and sisters. He condemned the moral bankruptcy of a nation that doesn't hesitate to invest in bombs and warfare around the world, but can't ever seem to find the dollars to eradicate poverty at home. But for me, you know, what makes King's speech essential in this moment is that he was arguing in that speech that if we as a nation, you know, do not awaken from our collective delusions, we are doomed. You know, he said we must rapidly shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. You know, he said when machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, you know, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism will never be conquered. You know, if we fail to make this turn, if we fail to awaken, we are doomed. And he was right. Whether we're talking about climate change, AI, mass deportation, mass incarceration, the wars in Gaza, or the wars on drugs, he's right that if we don't turn away from the corrupting forces of capitalism, militarism, and racism, and embrace a truly revolutionary love for all people and all creation, we are doomed. Towards the end of that speech at Riverside, you know, he said there is such a thing as being too late. You know, he said over the bleached bones and jumbled residue of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, too late. And yet his message wasn't a hopeless one. He was calling us to embrace a revolutionary movement, one that was grounded in an ethic of love. Just as bell hooks, you know, once said, you know, as long as we refuse to embrace love in our struggles for liberation, we will not be able to create a culture of conversion where there's a mass turning away from, you know, an ethic of domination. And that ultimately is what revolutionary love is all about and why I believe it is the only thing that can save us now.
Michelle Alexander, thank you so much for joining us. Civil rights advocate, author of the best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. We'll link to your piece in The Nation, headlined, Only Revolutionary Love Can Save Us Now. When we come back, Donald Trump meets with Hungary's authoritarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban at Mar-a-Lago last weekend. Stay with us. Hanan by the Palestinian musician and composer Clarissa Bithar. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. It's official. Following Tuesday's primaries, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump appear set for a rematch in November after both candidates secured enough delegates to win their party's nomination. This past weekend, Donald Trump hosted Hungary's Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, at Mar-a-Lago. Juan and I spoke yesterday with Hungarian Green activists. But first, let's go to President Trump praising Orban at Mar-a-Lago.
There's nobody that's better, smarter, or a better leader than Viktor Orban. He's fantastic. As you know, the Prime Minister of Hungary, and does a great job. He's a non-controversial figure because he said this is the way it's going to be, and that's the end of it, right? He's the boss.
To talk more about Orban and Trump, we spoke Tuesday with Gabor Schering, visiting fellow at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, assistant professor at Georgetown University in Qatar, Green Party member of the Hungarian parliament in 2010-14. His new piece, headlined, "I Watched Hungary's Democracy Dissolve into Authoritarianism as a Member of Parliament, and I See Troubling Parallels in Trumpism and its Appeal to Workers." I asked Schering to elaborate on what happened in Hungary and the parallels he sees here in the United States.
Indeed, as the title suggests, there are quite a few parallels between the United States and Hungary. But if we invite what happened in Hungary is basically now the country is the first authoritarian regime, first non-democracy in the European Union. And this democratic backsliding happened under Viktor Orban's leadership, who was elected in 2010 to lead the country, which is the same year I was elected to the Hungarian parliament. And back then, we had really high hopes as Green Party MPs to fix the country's economy and move towards sustainability. We had detailed policy plans. But within a few years, it became clear that Viktor Orban had other plans. He, as he said, he was building an illiberal state, and there negotiating policy proposals with the opposition was not part of the big picture. So he basically gradually conquered independent institutions. He staffed the courts, the public prosecution with his loyalists, so that any misconduct by those in power remained hidden. He has built a nationwide conservative media network that resembles the conservative media network in the U.S., but is even more centralized. And he has also used the state to kind of pressure media investors to fall in line. And we have seen examples of Donald Trump, while he was in power, doing that, pressuring media investors to fall in line with his narratives and cover him favorably. So these things are both happening in the two countries, but of course Hungary is much more advanced in this process of democratic backsliding. But there is certainly a mutual learning going on between the Republicans in the U.S. and Viktor Orban's party, Fidesz.
Gabor Schering, how was it that Orban was able to exercise this increased power? What was the role of the opposition parties or any checks and balances? How exactly did he do it?
Yeah, so within a few years, it turned out that basically the opposition was powerless inside the parliament because he was sidelining all the usual democratic mechanisms. He had his own policy team outside the ministries, outside the government machinery. So there was very often very little time to discuss his proposals. Sometimes he had to stay late until early in the morning because he introduced something just the day before. And then we had to prepare and go for a debate. And then there was voting just the next day. So he used the parliament as basically a stamping machine from early on. But then there are these other institutional aspects, like I mentioned, the media system is crucial, the court system, controlling it is also crucial. The courts are the last elements where you can still find some independence, but Orbán has been working quite heavily to conquer that part as well. And crucially, the prosecution is an important part of it. So that prosecutor's office makes sure that whenever there might be anything that is against the law, corruption-wise or related by government or people affiliated with the government, that thing stays hidden. But they can also rewrite the law, and they do that. They have done that. So, you know, they're increasingly not going against the law because the law favors them. Another element is gerrymandering and rewriting local electoral districts. This is something also we know from the U.S. The bird itself is coming from the U.S. But he also changed the electoral system in a way that favors Fidesz. So basically, this boils down to subverting democracy from the inside without violence, and that what makes this really a big challenge. And this is what these strongmen are doing around the world. They don't use the kind of the military anymore to subvert democracy, but they do this from the inside gradually. And I think this is what's inspiring also for Donald Trump and for other wannabe authoritarian populist leaders, because this gives them like a playbook of how to tilt the democratic playing field in a way that makes the job of the opposition and any independent institutions to check them very, very difficult.
Gábor Sharing, visiting fellow at the Center for European Studies at Harvard University, an assistant professor at Georgetown University in Qatar. He was a Green member of the Hungarian Parliament from 2010 to 2014. We spoke to him about his new pieces in The Conversation and Common Dreams. The headline, "I Watched Hungary's Democracy Dissolve into Authoritarianism as a Member of Parliament, and I See Troubling Parallels in Trumpism and Its Appeal to Workers." To see the whole interview we do with Gábor Sharing, you can go to democracynow.org. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, on Thursday, we'll speak with the acclaimed TV broadcaster and author Mehdi Hassan, who left MSNBC after his show was canceled. One of the most prominent Muslim voices on American television. In October, the news outlet Semaphore reported MSNBC had reduced the roles of Hassan and two other Muslim broadcasters on the network. And that does it for our show. Coming up next month, I'll be speaking at KPFA's 75th anniversary celebration in Berkeley. I can't wait to see everyone there in person in Berkeley on April 6th. Go to democracynow.org for details. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkadous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Gran, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Osbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. To see our podcasts, video and audio and transcripts of all shows, you can go to democracynow.org and check us out on Facebook. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hello, this is Kelly from the Peak Publication Society, SFU student-led newspaper. Recently, news organizations have been facing issues sharing news content. All news outlets, including small publications like us, have been affected due to Meta's refusal to comply with the Online News Act and compensate news companies. We have been serving our diverse student community for years and need your support to continue. If you'd like to contribute as a paid writer, illustrator, or photographer, follow us on Instagram at @thepeak@SFU. Keep reading our stories at the-peak.ca. If Meta is listening, we're just a community promoting SFU events. Please don't block us again.